During the 2008 presidential campaign, Barack Obama's pastor, Jeremiah Wright, was exposed as a radical and un-American when Fox News broadcast his statement, "It's not God bless America, it's goddamn America." For some Americans, that statement was enough to disqualify Obama for the presidency. However, this paper will defend Reverend Jeremiah Wright as a spokesman in the tradition of the Hebrew prophets and contend that Latter-day Saints and all Christians can learn from him. And we're pleased that William Russell is here for this session. He is widely published in Mormon studies, including his book, Homosexual Saints, The Community of Christ Experience, which is from John Whitmer Books, 2008. He is past president of both the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association. And in the beginning, he was telling me that he has also taught Sunday school using Fawn Brody's book. So I expect this to be a very interesting session for us all. Let's welcome William Russell.
Well, thanks, Katrine. We live in a little small county, about 8,000 people in our county, and there's 10 towns, but Lamoni is the biggest city at 2,000, but the county seat has a competitor at 1,800 people, so two large towns and eight smaller ones. But anyway, there's only one Catholic church in Decatur County, and that's Leon, the county seat, 17 miles away. But Sister Mary Ann, we got to be closer? Okay. Maybe that'll work. You don't think so?
No.
Yeah, I think it's on. Yeah, I'll just stand close. So Sister Mary Ann makes her rounds in Lamoni visiting the Catholic shut-ins. And one day she was in the Lamoni visiting the shut-ins. She was driving down Main Street, Lamoni, and she ran out of gas. But fortunately, the Senex station is just about a block and a half from where she came to halt. And so she walked down to the Senex station, and the manager said, "Well, I'm sorry, I just loaned out the last can about 10 minutes ago, and it's going to be a while before it comes back." So Sister Mary Ann was walking back to her car. She got back to the car and she realized, "I've got a bedpan in the car, you know, for shut-ins, you know." So she took it and she went back to the station and got it filled up with gas. And she's walking back to her car. Well, meanwhile, there's not any Mormon churches in Decatur County, but the next county north, the town of Osceola, has the ward that folks in Lamoni go to. And we get proselyted by missionaries, a decent amount. Well, two missionaries are walking down Main Street, walking towards Sister Mary Ann. They stopped and started watching her, saw what she was going to do with that bedpan. Then she got to the car and she poured the contents of that bedpan in the gas tank. So one missionary turned to the other and said, "If that car starts, I'm going Catholic." So, well, in the presidential election of 2007-2008, and I live in Iowa and I'm an activist, I was an early supporter of Barack Obama, so it's really a two-year campaign for activists in Iowa and in New Hampshire and South Carolina. And anyway, but Senator Obama's relationship with his pastor at the Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago's South Side became a great controversy, which threatened to derail Senator Obama's campaign. And it's my view that the Reverend Jeremiah Wright was greatly misunderstood by millions of Americans. Saw it so many times on not just Fox News, but so many other places. Greatly misunderstood by millions, and also because of the laziness of the American mass media reporters. So let me give you a couple of comments from two of my friends. One, a Community of Christ friend, who Lois and I visited last March, said that when I saw that Obama went to that church with that minister, there was no way I would ever vote for him. And the other, a Mormon scholar who's employed by the church, who some of you know, but I'm not going to name him, told me, "Of Reverend Wright, now there's a really weird religion." Well, do you think Reverend Wright's theology is weird? Well, then, if that's so, the Mormon theology of our two churches, the Mormon heritage of the RLDS and LDS, I think beats it. I'll talk about that later. Barack Obama was not raised in a church or a synagogue or a mosque, as some people might think, even though his white mother and her parents had a Methodist heritage in Kansas. But I don't think Barack ever was taken to church during his growing up years, but to any place. But as a young adult, a Columbia University graduate, working as a community organizer in South Chicago, Obama saw that the black churches were important agents of social change. And that's what he was all about, social change in the South Chicago area. So he decided to take a look at these churches, and he finally joined the Trinity United Church of Christ, where Reverend Jeremiah Wright was the minister. And Obama had also, during this process, studied very carefully the writings of two of the most important religious thinkers in America in the 20th century, Reinhold Niebuhr and Martin Luther King. Now, most of us here today inherited the church that we are currently attending, if we attend at all. And Barack Obama was an adult convert. Now, I don't know how LDS folks think, but I tend to believe that converts are seen as really bright people because you saw the light and you joined the right church. But anyway, the United Church of Christ is a church whose heritage goes back to New England Congregationalism, the Puritans, a church whose heritage includes some of the most respected people in American Christianity. Three of the greatest theologians in American history were United Church of Christ, or Congregational, the two Niebuhr brothers in the 20th century, and Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century. And also Lyman Beecher, often seen as one of the great preachers in American history as well. Definitely not a weird Christian denomination. Their theology is rooted in classic Christian orthodoxy, with a lot of influence from the Apostle Paul and Augustine and John Calvin and the Reformation wing, the Reformed wing of the 16th century Protestant Reformation. Now, it's true that something like one half of the Republicans in the United States have at one time or another believed that Barack Obama is really Muslim, his membership and involvement in the United Church of Christ to the contrary notwithstanding. That opinion requires either racial or political bigotry or profound ignorance. I see no other alternative than those three. Now, Reverend Wright's theology is really could be classified as a liberation theology, a respected theological perspective in Christian theology. Liberation theology sees God's main action in history as is being for the liberation of the oppressed. It is consistent with his faith, with the faith of ancient Israel, that God had acted in history to liberate the Israelites from slavery in Egypt. And it's no accident that the Exodus story has been central, especially during the years of slavery, central to worship experiences when blacks were able to worship without whites being there. But when the whites, when the masses was there, or just forced them to go to his church, then different passages were read, like Ephesians chapter 6. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with singleness of heart, as you obey Christ. The passage continues with further virtues of obeying the master. Colossians 3. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything. Romans 13:1, which is, I think, really an important one, because here Paul says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority but from God. And those institutions that exist have been instituted by God. Think slavery, maybe. These are really good scriptures to teach your slaves. A central text for liberation theology is that of Luke 4:18, where Jesus goes home to Nazareth and gets up in the synagogue and reads the following from the first two verses of chapter 61 of Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has appointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of the sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free. This can be seen as Jesus' keynote address at the beginning of his ministry. Now, 19 years ago, when Lois and I were courting, I wanted to know more about her religious views. In St. Louis, where she lived, some of her friends there were people I knew, and I thought of them as pretty fundamental or conservative people. And so, yeah, and some of them, you know, would be fundamental, but that's Protestant fundamentalism, infallible Bible. It's not some other kind of fundamentalism that involves polygamy and stuff like that. But anyway, then when I saw Lois sitting here in the middle, wearing a T-shirt with Luke 4:18 inscribed on it, I thought, well, okay, she's all right. Don Trompier, former dean of the Community of Christ Seminary and an expert on Latin American theology, writes, "The history of Latin American liberation theology has complexities, but clearly the most important figure is Gustavo Gutierrez, and the chief text is his book, A Theology of Liberation, 1973. But here in America, the key person on American black liberation theology would be James Cone, the theologian who published his book, what's the title? A Black Theology of Liberation. I used that book several times in the 70s, shortly after it was published, in my class on history of religion in America. I'd give them all three or four or five books to read, and that was a very worthwhile book for these white kids in my class in this rural Iowa community. Anyway, he had been a pastor in Detroit. He was, and he wrote the book. And later, at one of our most highly respected seminaries, he was a professor, Union Theological Seminary in New York City, home of Reinhold Niebuhr and John C. Bennett. Now, I hasten to explain that it's not the John C. Bennett who more than a century earlier was mayor of Nauvoo, a tiny village in Illinois that you've probably never heard of. Cone was the most highly recognized proponent of black liberation theology. And it's interesting, Reinhold Niebuhr also had been a pastor in Detroit in the 1920s, and the situation there in the rising auto industry caused Niebuhr to think differently, to change radically his theology because of the real problems he saw in that kind of situation. People were praising Henry Ford for, you know, trying to give wages high enough for people to buy his product, but Niebuhr saw beneath all that. During the controversy over Reverend Wright, excuse me, Martin Marty published an article in the Christian Century on his former student and friend, Jeremiah Wright. Marty, as you may know, is very likely easily the best known historian of American religion. And he has spoken at both Mormon History and John River Historical Association meetings. I was fortunate enough to have him there when I gave my presidential address in Omaha, the MHA, in 1983. About half the people there did not like my address, because I talked about how the study of history has revised my view of all three of the standard books of our church. Afterward, this elderly LDS couple came tottering forward, and I think maybe the woman just doesn't speak well because she's really getting quite old, but her husband said, "My wife here wanted me to tell you that she's always believed," that's what you just said, "she's always believed and finally happy to hear somebody say it." It's a revisionist thinking on scripture. But Cone was the big gun. And during the controversy over Wright then, Marty writes this article for the Christian Century, you know, probably the most highly respected Protestant religious magazine. Marty's a Lutheran, but he and his wife fairly frequently attended Reverend Wright's church. And he takes classes and so forth. And they became close friends. If Jeremiah Wright's detractors in 2007, 2008 had bothered to learn something about his life story, they would have had taken a different attitude toward the Reverend and toward his parishioner, Senator Obama. Let's look at Reverend Wright's biography. During the Vietnam War, he dropped out of college and joined the Marines. Contrary to many of his highly regarded Republican critics, super patriots who pushed for the Iraq War, who never served themselves, Contrast that to his service 3 years in the Marines, and then for 3 years he became a Navy hospital attendant type of thing. He worked in the hospitals. So Marty, anyway, would come to his church frequently. But anyway, after seminary, Wright saw an opening at the Trinity Church of Christ, a struggling church in South Boston. So he applied and was ordained pastor there. And the church has grown by leaps and bounds. I think I saw a figure of like 30,000 members, and it was a struggling church before. So he's very charismatic, successful pastor. Marty says that Trinity is a congregation where music stuns and uplifts. Visitors to the congregation, whether black or white, feel instantly at home. The church promotes physical and spiritual healing. They are devoted to education and are active in African Christianity. Professor Marty says that the charges against Reverend Wright are simply don't hold up. Wright was criticized for paying special attention to African Christianity. Well, now for a church made up largely of African Americans, seems kind of not too surprising they'd have some special affection for African Christianity. You know, how many churches do you know, Protestant churches, who have special regard for the ethnic group that largely respond, the people that come to their congregation? When I was in law school at Iowa City, there's three Catholic churches, and each one catered to a particular ethnic group. So hundreds of lay people share the ministry of this very large church. Their shared ministry reminds me of our churches, where there's this lay priesthood which shares the ministry in very, very significant ways. The most controversial snippets from some of Reverend Wright's sermons were played over and over again on Fox News and other right-wing outlets, showing just that concluding sentence. It says, "So it's not God bless America, it's God damn America," and saying it with emphasis. This is an example of the prophetic part of Wright's proclamation. Martin Marty notes that the prophets Amos and Micah cursed their people for their sins, much like Wright's statement when he said, "God damn America." And the curses of Amos and Micah are right there in the Bible for little kids to read. Now, here's some of the history out of which Reverend Wright's judgment of America came, leading to that conclusion about goddamn America. Our slaves came here in chains aboard slave ships, ripped from their families and communities and culture, and brought across the ocean as prisoners in slave ships. They were slaves for approximately 250 years. And as Chief Justice Roger Taney said in his decision, Dred Scott, 1857, "The Negro has no rights which the courts are bound to recognize. They are strictly property." After the emancipation of the slaves, gradually a system of Jim Crow segregation developed, whereby blacks were forced into segregated inferior schools, if at all, black public transportation, housing, and they were denied the right to vote. So they had no influence on making the laws of their city or state or country. They were mainly limited to the worst low-paying jobs. Many were sharecroppers in the South who had to make a contract like by January 15th or so, or some date in January, and they had to sign for 12 months, and they're obligated for that whole year. They had no right to change. But black men could be lynched for looking friendly at a white woman or any other violation of the mores of Southern white society, and thousands were lynched. My longtime friend, the late Frank Huff, was a former president of Graceland. In 1943, at the age of five, his father took young Frank to witness a lynching in Maryville, Missouri, just a few miles from Iowa, which was a free state. Missouri, of course, was a slave state, but kind of a mixed state. I guess Frank's father thought it would be good for his young son to see what happens to a black man who allegedly misbehaves. The alleged victim of the man's rape was the teacher at a dilapidated one-room schoolhouse. They tied the black man to the schoolhouse and burned the schoolhouse down. Nice thing for a five-year-old to see. And there wasn't any conviction of anybody who was involved in that. They were probably represented some of the leaders of the community. The criminal justice system treated African Americans terribly, North and South, present day as well as in the past. We've seen some big illustrations of this recently. So this is long overdue. And I appreciated Barack Obama when he recently said, we need reform, he's going to push for it in the prison system, the criminal justice system. I appreciated his statement in that Oklahoma federal prison a couple weeks ago after he'd sat with five men who had long sentences for drug crimes. Obama admitted in his first book, long before he probably ever thought of running for president, that he used marijuana and maybe other drugs, I'm not sure, as a teenager. And so when Obama said, there but for the grace of God go I. Now here he is, drug user as a child, as a young teenager, now the president of the United States. But here's these guys sitting around the table with him, serving long, terrible, unreasonable sentences for drug use. And so there, but for the grace of God, go I. With this kind of history for black Americans, no wonder Reverend Wright could say, not God bless America, but God damn America, after going through this history. I cringe when, I remember Frederick Douglass's classic statement about 4th of July. Of what appeal is the 4th of July to black folks? Very good comment. I cringe, though, when I see President Obama almost always end his speeches with the words, God bless America. I suppose he thinks it's politically necessary, given his people claim he's Muslim and so forth, and not really an American, wasn't born here. But I wish he would add a phrase, God bless America and all the people of the world, but that probably wouldn't be politically wise either. America deserves a judgment of God for what we have done through our history, not only to African Americans, but also Native Americans, Hispanics, Asian Americans, women, Jews, Catholics, GLBT people, and more recently, Muslims. Our history ain't pretty, folks, but our history text usually play down these sorts of problems we've had. I wonder if Christians, including clergy, who condemned Reverend Wright for proclaiming goddamn America, have ever read the Hebrew prophets, especially Amos and Micah. Amos, after reciting the sins of their own people, Israel, he came to this conclusion. I despise your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of your fatted animals, I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Amos 5, 21, 4. Three chapters earlier, Amos had written, he condemned them for, you sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They who trample the heads of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of their way. Chapter 2. Reverend Wright was in sync with this prophetic condemnation of the powers that be. Amos would probably say a similar thing to what Jeremiah Wright said if he were here today. We Latter-day Saints have prophets in our tradition, although we treat it as a priesthood office. But the Hebrew prophets really only exercise the function, prophesying, which is not predicting the future. It's proclaiming what they regard to be the divine will for what's going on today and judgment for the sins of the current time. In fact, same Amos and some of the other prophets denied that they were prophets or priests or held any kind of formal function. The Reverend Jeremiah Wright was an American prophet, like Martin Luther King Jr. Remember, King was hated by most whites until he was killed, and then he became a hero. And liberation theology was just beginning to be noticed at the time King was killed. King certainly had a lot of in common with liberation theology and with Reverend Wright. In 1968, when he was murdered, they tend to do that to prophets. Cone's book, first book on liberation theology was just 2 years later. Think of Gandhi, Dr. King, Archbishop Romano, Malcolm X, the early Christian martyrs, the martyrs of the Reformation period in the 16th century and on, they exercised the prophetic function and were killed because their prophetic voice was not appreciated by the powers that be. See, I see Jesus as having been very popular with the people, as you see in Mark chapter 11, I think it is. And in fact, it also goes on to say, and that's when they realized, the powers that be realized they had to kill him because he was getting too big a following. In our Community of Christ World Conferences over the years, whenever we have a revelation written by the prophet and approved by the delegates assembled, we get a chance to debate the revelation. Is this really from God or is this just from Satan or whatever? And approved to be in the Doctrine and Covenants. When that happens, we have a tradition of having four high church officials escort the prophet, because he's been in his office during the debate, not so they could have a free debate, I guess. They escort him down the center aisle. We sang, I don't really sing it, but we sing, "We thank thee, O God, for a prophet." You guys have that hymn in your hymnal, I think, yeah. But anyway, in my first 6 years out of college, I was an editor at Herald House, our publishing house, and I was taking Bible courses at the Methodist Seminary where I got my Master of Divinity degree. I've never had people able to get very many people, even my wife Lois, to take seriously the divinity part of my degree, Master of Divinity. Only Glenn Lambert has been recognized that aspect of my degree. Anyway, in seminary, I was really taking all the Bible courses they offered, and I was and really was drawn to the Hebrew prophets. And so at conference, now I'd be sitting in a big open space behind the platform where the big muckety mucks sit, and when they walked the prophet down the aisle, we're all singing, "We thank thee, O God, for a prophet." It really made me sick, because I've contrasted it to Amos and Micah and the other Isaiah and so forth. Most of the revelations in those days in our church were pretty namby-pamby. You know, Israel Smith or his brother Wallace, W. Wallace Smith, calling leaders to high offices, making rather namby-pamby statements about whatever. There really wasn't much that you'd call inspirational in it. And as the prophet was escorted down the aisle, at one of those conferences, I had my own revelation. And my own revelation was, we thank thee, O God, for a prophet is not the normal response to real prophecy. Real prophets are not sung, "We thank thee, O God, for a prophet" at. Real prophets are normally despised, spit at, or killed. Understandably, social justice was a special concern for Reverend Wright, serving a poor neighborhood of blacks in South Chicago. Martin Marty acknowledges that Wright had his shortcomings, like he honored Minister Louis Farrakhan, who, that's probably a mistake. But anyway, it's no accident that Mitt Romney, like Barack Obama, didn't particularly want their religion to be brought into the debate. Because Obama knew, you know, that Wright was controversial, and Wright had been very influential to Obama. And Romney knew that many Americans, think Mormonism is kind of weird. neither one wanted to talk about it. They both were kind of forced into talking about religion at a certain point in the campaign. For my Mormon friend, who said that Reverend Wright's religion was really, really weird, I note that most Americans who aren't Mormon look at it a little differently. For example, claiming that their founder had dug up an allegedly ancient document written in Reformed Egyptian, whatever that is, biblical figures 2,000 years old, dropping by for a friendly visit on this farm boy from Western New York, polygamy in 19th century America, plurality of gods, 22 centuries after the ancient Israelites concluded that there's really only one God, Yahweh. These other gods don't exist. Israel goes through a long process before they finally determine by the 5th century there's just one God. But now the Mormons, we can all be God, except for Linda and Janice, etc., etc. Baptizing for the dead? Now, if I were baptized LDS, And then it was baptized for proxy for my ancestor, Rhys Samuel, born in Wales in 1848. Would Rhys have a better chance for salvation because I got baptized for him? That's weird. I wish I could help Rhys, because he really needs help. Rhys was born, the public records in Wales show that Rhys was born illegitimate. And if you read your scriptures thoroughly, you will have noticed that Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 2 says, "No bastard shall enter the assembly of the Lord until the 10th generation." Now, I'm about 6th generation, so I guess there's no hope for me either. And finally, Joseph Smith, claiming to have translated a document written by Abraham, who lived about 2,000 years before Christ. Would Abraham have even been literate? I don't know. Susan might be able to help us on that. She's much more schooled in language than me. Finally, Joseph Smith claimed to have translated a document. Meanwhile, despite what my friend said, Reverend Wright's liberation theology is very much in keeping with Orthodox Christianity. It's not weird. It is basic Christian theology. They believe in the classic Christian orthodoxy hammered out in the early centuries of the Christian church from Apostle Paul down through the Council of Chalcedon in 451. Wright's church is Trinity United Church of Christ. They're Trinitarian. Mormons aren't. Meanwhile, despite what my friend said, Wright's liberation theology is very much in keeping with Orthodox Christianity. I was shocked at how shallow and distorted the media coverage of Reverend Wright was. It made me appreciate how difficult it is to run for president. Think of what it's been like for Barack Obama, with all the garbage, all the lies thrown at him. And for a politician at any level, it's really difficult to respond to those. And you can't sue him because they're going to say, well, you're a public figure and you can't recover. They get to say anything they want to say about you. Some people refuse to believe the lies that our president is a Muslim and was not born in the United States, but many do believe those lies. If Lois and I lived within driving distance of the Trinity Church in South Chicago, especially when Reverend Wright was there, I think we would want to go there for church. Maybe not on a regular basis. We might have our own affiliation with Community of Christ there, but I think we'd want to slip away and go to Reverend Wright's church occasionally. Many of you know Catherine Stokes, African-American woman, fairly prominent Mormon, I believe, had her career in Chicago, and she told me Wednesday night, first of all, she said she's glad I was going to be talking about this, but she was not going to be here today. She told me Wednesday night that I think it was about 20 African-American kids, high school kids, I think, that she took to Reverend Wright's church one Sunday, and it's the very Sunday that he said, "God damn America." And she said, "The people in the congregation and these strangers that I brought, it was perfectly logical what they heard." You know, hearing all the rehearsing that history. Well, of course, we don't appreciate America like other folks do. Remember Michelle Obama. She made a statement in 2007, sort of indicating, "I kind of feel like I am an American now, like I didn't before." And she's pilloried as an angry black woman. And hereafter, she finally gets to be a first lady, gets to be well known, about the most popular person in the United States of America, more popular than her husband for sure. In some ways, I think the African-American churches in America are the truest Christian churches, to use kind of a familiar phrase about true and truest churches. When Lois and I were in Alabama last March, we had to spend a Sunday at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, the church where four black girls about 12 to 14 were killed by a Ku Klux Klan bomber on Sunday morning, right at the end of Sunday school, September of 65. Sadly, many of us in the Mormon tradition, my side of it and your side of it and the others, there's a lot of Mormon traditions, you know. Sadly, many of us know very little about classic Christian orthodoxy and the creeds that which articulate those basic doctrines. Joseph Smith called the creeds an abomination, or words to that effect, nonsense. They were the result of centuries of debate as to the meaning of the Christ event. Most of the specific doctrines spelled out in the early church, early Christian churches, and later, are believed the vast majority of them are believed by LDS Mormons and by Community of Christ folks. I did a lot of cutting here because Lois told me it was too long. Okay, we remember to separate our Christianity and our Mormonism, whatever brand. We need to remember to separate our Christianity and our Mormonism of whatever brand from American nationalism, from American patriotism. And we often confuse that. Yet we have the separation of church and state, and yet we don't really honor it in many ways. In fact, some prominent politicians are even saying the Constitution doesn't have any such a thing as a separation of church and state. The only argument they can use there is the words separation of church and state do not appear in the Constitution. But the First Amendment is clear we have a separation of church and state. The LDS Church and the Community of Christ have members all over the world. You folks have a heck of a lot more than we do, probably about 40 times more. We are world religions. We're not just American religions, although in a way we are, but I mean, we are trying to be world religions anyway. We're in 50 countries, and I'm sure you're in an awful lot more countries than that. National patriotism should be left out of our religious expression. The Community of Christ is in 50 countries, and I'm sure that's far fewer than the number of countries, that you have. Resolutions submitted to our World Conference are expected to have a world focus and not strictly an American focus. And if they have strictly an American focus, the presiding officer, usually the president, will rule that resolution out of order and won't be considered. One of my professors in seminary told the story of a Methodist minister who had both the cross and the American flag at the front of the sanctuary where everybody could see it. Eventually the cross needed to be fixed, so it was gone for 2 or 3 weeks. Nobody seemed to notice. At least no one mentioned anything to the pastor. Later, the flag needed to be mended or replaced, so it was gone for 2 or 3 weeks. People were up in arms. Where's the flag? They apparently hadn't noticed the absence of the cross. Now, do we go to church to worship Christ or to worship our country? The Eastern Orthodox churches are national churches that no church-state separation. How well has that worked out? Do we want to go down that path? I think a careful study of what the evangelists wrote in the four Gospels in the New Testament leads us to a natural conclusion that Jesus was a disciple of the Hebrew prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets like Amos and so forth. But Jesus was also a critic of the law as found in the Bible, the Torah, the first five books. I'm sure we all know of times in the Bible where Jesus ignores the law and is criticized by the Pharisees or whatever. And he said, well, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And as I taught a course on Matthew at our church for 25 Sundays, and the thing that we noticed was that Matthew always has Jesus criticizing the law, but never criticizing the Hebrew prophets. Matthew has quotes the Old Testament a lot, but that's the system. Just to give you a couple examples from Matthew, there's many. Late in chapter 5, Matthew makes a strong challenge to the law of divorce in the Torah, the law, the Bible, whatever, in Matthew chapter 5. In Deuteronomy, the law says that a man can divorce his wife with no explanation required, and the wife certainly doesn't have any right to divorce him. She's his property. Leviticus 19:12 teaches us not to swear falsely, but Jesus tells us not to swear at all. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus and his disciples go through the grain fields on the Sabbath, plucking heads of grain because they're hungry. The Pharisees condemn them for doing what's unlawful to do on the Sabbath. But Jesus defends their actions, citing King David and a priest who violated this provision of the law, ending with the statement, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Now Mark, the earliest gospel, written before Matthew and Luke, have them say the Sabbath is made for humankind and not humankind for the Sabbath, but that probably a little too far out for people with stronger Jewish backgrounds. So Matthew and Luke omit it when they come to that point of Mark's account. They copy 90% of more of Mark's account. Jesus is criticized for healing on the Sabbath. Again, he challenges the law on that. Obviously, the author of Matthew, like I say, was not a fundamentalist. He thought everything in the Bible should be considered true, word for word. Fundamentalism is, in my view, a 20th century American heresy. It was unknown to Calvin and Luther and Wesley and all. They never had such an idea of every word in the scripture is true. I think it's important to indicate how Jesus, was this critic of the law, but a disciple of the prophets, and biblical fundamentalists often cite the law to defend conservative approaches to Christian faith, like capital punishment and God condemning homosexual acts. The liberation theology is based on the faith that the primary work of God in history is freeing those who are oppressed and marginalized in their society. As for these religious right churches today, who have made an unholy alliance with the Republican Party, I wonder if they quote the Hebrew prophets much at all when they preach, especially when these prophets advocate social justice. That political alliance between many Christian conservatives corrupts the Christian message of peace and justice for the poor and protecting our environment. The price of the allegiance, the alliance, and the Christian rights support for hawkish foreign policy and politics which produce budgets which, in the words of Reverend Lowry, King's close associate, budgets with billions more for war, but no more for the poor. I think that they cite social justice passages in the Hebrew Bible. I think they cite the social justice passages of the Hebrew Bible because they call for a different kind of response in the political order. That is, prophetic response, which puts in judgment all political rhetoric and decisions. I might have messed that up a little bit, but I think you understand. I'm deciding at 77, I need to print in larger type. Since so many of our American Christians today don't distinguish clearly the gospel found in the New Testament from American patriotism, it is not no surprise that many American Christians don't realize that the Reverend Jeremiah Wright taught a gospel deeply rooted in the Hebrew prophets, the Jesus of the New Testament, and classic Christian orthodoxy. The Reverend Wright's gospel deserves our respect rather than the condemnation that he received at the end of his career, at the end of his long and distinguished career. We would do well to appropriate his teachings in our own proclamations of the gospel. In fact, I would highly recommend that occasionally you just drop in on a really serious black church that preaches a prophetic social gospel. I want to close with a true story that's more or less related to this topic. In 1988, a woman was waiting in line at the Miami airport. She had recently married, she's American, she had recently married a Norwegian and they were moving to Norway. Her husband flew out the day before and she was going to follow him the day later. But she just had enough money, she just brought the money that she thought she needed. And he'd taken the rest, I guess. So she gets to the airport and discovers there's $105 in charges that they were not aware of. And she did not have anywhere near that kind of money. She was desperate and crying. A young black man behind her said, "Don't cry, I'll pay your fees." So he handed her $105. She was so happy, and she took his name and address so she would send and promise to send him the money when she got to Norway, which she did immediately. The young man was a low-paid community organizer from Chicago. 19 years later, she discovered that this nice young man was running for president of the United States. Character matters. And somewhere along the line, Mr. Obama learned this gift of sharing with those in need and distress. Maybe he got this at the Trinity United Church of Christ and the preachings and ministry of the pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Thank you. I'm just going to stand here because I don't want to climb that big step. I just had knee surgery.
What is you know, as everything dies down, is Jeremiah, what's he doing? Is he still at the same church?
Well, he was retiring at the time. I mean, like, he was just weeks or months away from retirement when the controversy came up. I hear he does lecturing and stuff around the country, but strictly as a retired minister. He got an awful lot of invitation to speak, you know, before he ever became controversial. Simpson College, where my brother-in-law used to be president, but after he was president. Simpson College, near our place, invited him in to give like a weekend series of lectures and some sort of a conference, and Methodist school in Indianola, Iowa. So he still does a lot of that, I guess. I don't really know much about how seriously he's retired and how seriously he still is active on a volunteer basis or as requested. Jake.
I remember when all this was going on, I thought, well, didn't President Obama kind of distance himself during the campaign?
Yeah. Yeah. There were two occasions when Reverend Bright's controversy came to light. The first one wasn't as difficult for Barack to handle as the second one. And so he, the first time he just said, you know, he's my pastor, he's my minister, I could never you know, divorce him. That would have been the words he used. But then the second one was, I don't know if that was when the goddamn American one or what, but I know Obama said, well, I really wasn't there. You know, when he was gone, Obama was gone a lot, so he wouldn't have been to church all every Sunday. So he indicated first he hadn't heard that goddamn America. But then he distanced himself more, and I don't remember exactly how he did it. But he managed to survive it. I think one reason he did was he finally gave that talk on race in Philadelphia, I believe it was. And it was so well done. It's been often referred to as just, you know, he's a good speaker. It's often referred to as one of his classic speeches, one of the best, one of the best speeches on race in history. Yes? I think if you just go to the times he served as more or less pastor in chief, when he's gone to Tucson and after the people were killed by the shooter, or he's gone to Joplin after the tornado, and several other places, including this recent one in Charleston, South Carolina, he exudes Christianity in his talk, and he's well read in Dr. King and Martin and Reinhold. You weren't here for that a part of the speech, I think, but he's well read in Reinhold Niebuhr, probably the most respected American theologian of the 20th century, and Dr. King, well read in those. So yeah, like Dr. King himself, he exudes Christianity in his speeches.
He could say it, but does he have to practice it?
Well, people have to make that judgment, but I think he's practiced it better than most any other president we've had in a long time. Yeah, I mean, when he's finished as president, if he took some sort of job where he went around the country and spoke when there's really tense situations, he just does a miraculous and Christian job. I mean, those speeches he's given at those places I just mentioned, I thought, man, this guy could be a great pastor, you know, of maybe a church with 30,000 members like Reverend Wright. Yes. Oh, okay. How did this fundamentalism develop in American Protestantism? Well, it was a reaction to modernism or liberalism, you know, with the Enlightenment, and in the 18th and 19th century, more like the biblical scholarship arose, where they took a critical look, and critical not necessarily mean negative, but took a critical look at the Bible and decided, well, you know, the five books of the law weren't written by Moses, they're written later, and so forth. Paul didn't write all those books that had a name on it, and the four Gospels are all anonymous. They were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That type of biblical criticism, for one, starting in German universities in the 18th century, then came to England and America in the 19th century. Fundamentalism was a reaction to that. And there was a school called the Princeton Theologians in the last half of the 19th century, Charles Hodge and Abe Warfield and so forth. Were really big arguers for literalism. In fact, Hodge, in his systematic theology, declared the Bible to be, you know, literally true, every word. And then in the 1860s and 70s, modernism was making its point a little more clearly about how difficult it is to hold that position. So he revises it in 1879 and says the Bible is pure, literally true, insofar it has been correctly translated. I think that's a phrase that we've heard before. So that was the background. And then in the first decade of the 20th century, in the Midwest, I think it was out of Chicago largely, there's a couple of brothers caused to have offered a series of tracts called The Fundamentals, and they articulated that position. And that continued to be very strong. You might remember hearing about the Scopes trial in 1925, where Tennessee said, well, you can't teach evolution in the public schools, and came to trial over that. So in most of the American Protestant denominations, there's a big battle over this new fundamentalism idea. But that was a reaction to liberalism, which had dominated the theology of at least American Protestantism up to that time. So I think it was in the Fundamentals in 1910 or so, they said there are five important doctrines that are absolutely can't be set aside. Actually, if it's fundamental, why do you have to have five? They're all perfect, but five especially, they were kind of being backed into a corner. And so, the virgin birth and literal resurrection of Christ and the resurrection of worthy souls and so forth. Substitutionary theory of atonement, which I think is a horrible idea. We were saved simply because Christ shed his blood. I think that's kind of ridiculous. But anyway, there were five principles that pretty much have governed, what fundamentalism means. And so the leading Protestant churches had big battles. By the end of the 1920s, the liberals or the modernists had won most of those battles. But it keeps resurging, keeps rearing its ugly head, in my opinion. That's particularly my opinion. And I think it's a terrible heresy, because there's so many stupid things in the Bible, like that one I read from Deuteronomy. No bastard shall enter the assembly of the Lord. Me, Samuels wasn't responsible for being born a bastard, I'm not responsible for sixth generation. It's not my fault. What could be more insidious than that? So anyway, that's why I call it a 20th century heresy in America. And I don't think Christianity in other countries is afflicted with that disease as much as we are. Yeah, Jack. Yeah. He could easily say that, yeah. Maybe he did quote Jefferson on that, yeah.
But the other thought that I've been wondering if you've been talking is the way we use the term God bless.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me in two very distinctive ways, it's a singular different way.
Mm-hmm.
One is I can say, God bless you, Bill. That was a great talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the other sense is that if you were in the hospital and ailing and I went to your bedside, I might say, God bless you, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be calling God's blessings on you.
Yeah.
In order to fix what
yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems to me, Reverend Wright, from probably people who were most grateful to him for being in America, he was saying that in the first sense.
Mm-hmm.
That it was that we are worthy of damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Way,
he
might also have said, God bless America. That is, America, we need God bless America.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, got a chain of thought going in my mind.
Sounds like a good chain of thought, yeah. But I think you're right. Maybe there's a third way, too. Sometimes, we'll think, poor old Jake here, he's really a sad soul. God bless you, Jake. I hope you shaped up. I think that might sometimes happen, too. But we do have hope for you. okay. Now, the latter part, tell your wife. Others, I don't know how much time we have, but other.
I think we have time for one more question. Mm-hmm. What was the name of the book you handed out to your students?
A Black Theology of Liberation by James Cone. Published, in 1969. A Black Theology of Liberation. In fact, one of my students was Susan Curtis, and she was just from a good Republican family in Southwest Iowa, good Methodist, conservative Methodist family. She came to Grayson because Simpson, where my brother-in-law was president, had too much of a radical reputation. Well, Grayson's probably not going to be. Well, she took classes from me and Bill Yonke, and Paul Edwards, and she came away a different person. She became quite left-wing in politics and in religion, and she's now a professor of intellectual history at Purdue. And anyway, and her writing is all in black theology. Oh, not theology, but black history. She does a lot of studying at the Schoenberg Museum in New York City. So anyway, thank you.